Hi, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to Beats Research Radio, a podcast and YouTube channel dedicated to bringing our community closer to research in the science and engineering fields. My name is Fiona Haugen, a student from the Translational and Molecular Medicine program at the University of Ottawa, and I'll be your host on today's special podcast episode for the Science Communication TMM 4950 course. Breathing is often taken for granted, yet this shouldn't be the case as some populations struggle to catch their breaths under the weight of their living conditions. Today we will discuss the disproportionate prevalence of obstructive lung disease in the urban poor population of Ottawa, Canada's capital city. To discuss the topic, we have invited Dr. Smita Pakale, Senior Scientist in Clinical Epidemiology at the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute, respirologist at the Ottawa Hospital, and Associate Professor at the School of Epidemiology, Public Health, and Preventative Medicine at the University of Ottawa. Hi, Dr. Pakale, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me, and thank you for your interest in this subject matter.
In 2021, you published a paper investigating the prevalence and burden of obstructive lung disease in the urban poor population of Ottawa, Canada. To get us started, could you give us a brief overview of your research and how you went about conducting the study?
This research is part of our research program, which is a community-based research center in Ottawa. Later, people named it as the Bridge Engagement Center, the Bridge for short, where we do research in partnership with people who self-identify themselves as either unhoused or insecurely housed or low income, racialized, including lots of indigenous people. As you know, in urban poor population, there's overrepresentation of indigenous people. So at the Bridge, we conduct research in true partnership with people from the population that I just defined, sit at a table, research question comes from them. We design tools together, including questionnaire. They do the recruitment, they do the consenting, people are involved in the data analysis. So people are involved in every aspect of the process of the research, and that makes the Bridge projects rich. And this project that we are discussing here is part of the bigger project, which was a PROMPT project, which was our participatory research attacking tobacco head on, because that came from the previous project, which was a PROUD project, where we learned the sociodemographics and people learned almost 100% people do have a tobacco dependence. And that's why they wanted to take tobacco head on. And that's why the PROMPT project was born. So all my research is motivated by my interest in health inequity.
Out of curiosity, as the creator of the Bridge Engagement Center, where did this name come from?
So we've been working with the population and this kind of environment of participation and engagement beyond just consultation since past several years. While we were designing and doing this, people wanted to name the place. So we had a meeting when people came up with this name because they see this place as bridging the gap, bringing people together, creating this safe space where people do not have that in the community. So that's how they came up with this name, as where people engage and from different walks of life with different social determinants behind them. And everybody is seen as a person and not labeled or stigmatized. So that kind of a bridging gap they mean by that name.
Thank you for sharing the meaning. Now, you mentioned this project is mainly focused on tobacco dependency and the effects this has on at-risk populations. Could you describe why this is so important to further investigate, particularly in Ottawa, and the effects that lung disease has on individuals in their day-to-day life?
Yeah, so as I said, this is part of the larger project, the PROMPT project. And as you may know, Canada has done a lot of progress. So even when we began this project, that was well before the pandemic, Ottawa had one of the lowest smoking rate in whole of Ontario, because Ottawa is like the hillgoers and parliamentarians and sophisticated, educated population. Ottawa tobacco smoking rate even then was 9 to 12%, well ahead of Ontario, well ahead of rest of Canada. When we had just completed the PROUD project, where 100% people with tobacco dependence, just merely 2 blocks from the Parliament Hill of a country very rich like Canada. So that was quite an eye-opener, because tobacco dependence is directly related to causing number of diseases. Over 24 diseases are associated with tobacco smoking, and one of them is multiple lung diseases. And out of those lung diseases, asthma and COPD are quite common. And many people with tobacco dependence, if they have asthma, their asthma will be exacerbated. They will have multiple emergency room visits. They will have multiple attacks. And if you smoke tobacco for a long period of time, you develop something called COPD, which is like an ongoing disease, which causes destruction of your lungs and limiting symptoms such as shortness of breath and cough, which limits your quality of life and quantity of life. It's a progressive disease. So the obstructive lung disease is a category which is diseases like asthma, COPD, bronchiectasis. But essentially what people have is a lot of cough and sputum production and phlegm and sticky mucus and limited lung function.
That sounds like an incredibly debilitating disease to live with. Now, you mentioned how tobacco dependency is highly correlated to social determinants of health. Could you expand on how these factors are the key drivers in the development of tobacco dependency?
Yeah, so social determinants of health could be an academic term. But for people in day-to-day life, it means a lot of different things. And in context of tobacco, if I can tell you, tobacco does not happen in isolation. So tobacco dependence, the smoking, it does not happen in isolation. So you could be indigenous, you could be poor, you could be racialized, you could be having some other factors around you in terms of your background, where you come from, your family, income, occupation, and all of these factors are kind of entwined. They are integrated into one's identity. So it's called, you know, we use nowadays the term of intersectionality because there are multiple identities. So similarly, a lot of social determinants of health exist around people and they interact, they intersect. And that's how tobacco, substance use, mental health issues, they do not occur in isolation. So that's why considering all these other factors, which we call social determinants of health, are very, very important if you want to understand the disease burden or what management strategies would be useful.
As you mentioned earlier, the Bridge Engagement Center focuses on forming connections with at-risk populations and discussing their needs. Your website in particular highlights that the Bridge builds trust with marginalized communities. Could you elaborate on how you do this and why?
It's years of work at the Bridge, how we build the trust with the people that we work with. And trust building is a very arduous, labor-intensive, and time-consuming task. So unless until you are interested in putting that time, putting that effort, accepting defeat, humility, treating people like people, bringing the power imbalances, and all of that takes a lot of time and a lot of commitment and a lot of perseverance and accepting mistakes. We made a lot of mistakes, right? And so unless until we are committed for that, we should not be using the terminologies like we commonly use, patient engagement, citizen engagement, participation. And these terminologies are used so often. But unless until that kind of commitment is there in the process of trust building, because it does not come easy, but and it's an ongoing process, and we got to continue to invest the time and resources to build that trust. Because, you know, most of the systemically marginalized, systemically oppressed population, may it be indigenous, may it be racialized, may it be people with mental health issues, substance use, trust is rarely found in this population. People have mistrusted them. People have misused them. People have used their data. People have done research on them. People have taken away from them a lot of things rather than given or shared with them. And that is the history. And that's why the trust is scarcely found. So the building of trust where they begin, where they are, is a difficult task. It's an arduous task. It's a time consuming task.
I think that is something that stood out to me with this particular study is that in your paper, you included quotes from individuals that were a part of the study. And as a reader, that really helped me empathize with the issue at hand and realize that it is people in our community, our very own neighbors, that are in dire need of support. And one thing in particular that was surprising to me was that your paper was published only in 2021, and it was the first paper to study lung disease in an urban poor population. Why do you think this area of research is so understudied?
Good question. And that's a question we ponder every day. Most of the studies, we were talking about obstructive lung disease, the common diseases like asthma and COPD, which is very common. most of the studies, 95% white men, not even women. So forget about everybody else and other colored people and other. So these studies have been done in multi-site, multiple centers around the world. And that is how everywhere you look at cancer research, you look at many different, and the guidelines are based on that. So most of the time we just do the research, you know, how it is convenient for us. I always say we proactively exclude people who actually use most healthcare resources, because a lot of people in this population are very sick. They are carrying disproportionate burden of diseases like mental health and stigma and racism and stereotype. They are put in jail, police brutality, on and on and on. And that causes a lot of stress and manifests into physical elements like diseases, right? And so they use healthcare resources when everything else is broken. And yet they are not seen anywhere in the studies. And that is the main impetus for our research, to turn the mainstream research upside down, inside out, and focus on people who are discarded, who are not even included in any mainstream research. Otherwise, we will not be an inclusive society. We try to use the EDI language in equity, diversity, inclusion, but it is not reflected in our actions.
From the sounds of it, there is evidently a lot of work that needs to be done on a system-wide level. How do you hope your research will influence the current system in place to address these health and social inequities? And do you think there's a way the public can do its part?
I think we are making a little bit dent now that we are in this interview. However, as you know, the society, we have a long way to go. As a society, we are too polarized, we are too divided, we stigmatize people. I always say at the bridge, what we do is we treat humans like human. And that's when magic happens. And that's why our study shows very much positive effects beyond what we had actually imagined, and even the people and participants and the community peer researchers have thought of. So it has its value, it has its place, its impact remains to be seen, but we need to do a lot of more work to undo the damage, to undo the mainstream research where there's 95% white men, in order to make changes at the policy level. Because all those studies are feeding the policy. The policy is based on those studies. The guidelines are based on those studies where there are 95% white men. So we got to change that. We have to do more research. In our research, we involve policymakers and the power holders since the beginning of the research, through the process, and they are engaged right from the grant writing. We engage people from Health Canada, Indigenous Services Canada, so that they know what we are doing, Public Health Agency of Canada, and keeping those elements involved in the process, we hope the policy changes will come.
You are evidently very passionate about this subject, and I'm very glad we have someone like you advocating for those that need it. From our conversation today, what do you want the audience to remember most?
Yeah, so your earlier question was, and I didn't touch upon that, is how can other people help? And this help is a very nuanced topic in my head, because in a North American context or any society, you help the poor. It's like a top-down approach. Even to the help is a top-down approach. You help because, oh, I went to Mexico and built some houses, and then you went your merry way to a vacation. You do what you want to do. In my dictionary, that's not help. Help is what people want when they want it, not at your convenience. So you got to ask people then what they want. But in order to ask people what they want, so that they tell you, you need to have developed that trust. Unless the trust is there, they will not tell you. So to engage with people, to develop that trust, to really work in partnership and not have this top-down approach would be the beginning.
That is a wonderful message, and I really hope our audience can take that to heart, just like I know I will. Thank you for enlightening us on the subject, Dr. Pakale. It was a pleasure having you here with us today, and we look forward to seeing what findings will be brought to light next, thanks to your research.
Thank you so much for your interest again. Thank you.
We'd also like to thank our audience for joining us today. This episode was produced by Mairead Green, hosted by Fiona Haugen, written by Amandine Court-Molche, and audio produced by Jade Poirier. All copyrights reserved to Beats Research Radio and the University of Ottawa. Make sure to tune in next week For more of Beats Research Radio, make sure to look for us on Instagram, YouTube, and Spotify.